finance combinations under common control, and we'll first have a presentation by the Hong Kong Institute, and I give the floor to Christina.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me loud and clear?
Loud and clear.
Very good. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for getting us on the video to make a short presentation on just some fact-finding exercise that we did here in Hong Kong. The reason why we undertook this study in conjunction with the ISB's research project is because, as you may be aware, Hong Kong is one of the world's most active capital markets for raising funds from an IPO. And we knew that most, if not all, listing applicants perform some form of common control combination for the purpose of IPO. And now, I don't know if the ISB research project in terms of the scope has changed, but I understand, I think, early this year that the staff was going to focus on pre-IPO common control combinations. So, therefore, the information paper that we prepared, which is ASAF paper 6A, focuses primarily on pre-IPO common control combinations in Hong Kong. And what we wanted to do is first explore the reasons for the high prevalence of common control combinations in Hong Kong, and then secondly, to understand the current practice and issues when accounting for common control combinations, and finally, to understand what are the financial information needs of our investor community. So just a couple of, just one very big disclaimer, the information in this paper doesn't actually represent the views of the HKICPA or our standard setting committees or the staff. So I'll just pause here and I'll let Cam, who's sitting on next to me, she's a staff in charge on of this project in Hong Kong, I'll let her introduce the relevant requirements and the Hong Kong accounting guidance on this topic.
Hi, everybody. So I just wanted to give a brief summary of the Hong Kong listing rule requirements for IPOs. So I'll cover a key point, which is that essentially financial information that covers three financial years immediately preceding to the issue of the IPO prospectus is required to be provided by listing applicants. We'll be calling this a track record period for the rest of the paper and our discussion. But the purpose of this track record period is so that the listing applicants can demonstrate that the business has, the directors and management of the entity has sufficient and satisfactory experience in at least 3 years in the related line of business and industry, and that the business is fit to continue. Now, what does this actually mean for common control combinations prior to an IPO? Essentially, these listing applicants will prepare the financial statements using the predecessor method in order to meet this track record period requirement. The Hong Kong ICPA has also issued an accounting guideline in 2005. So when Hong Kong adopted IFRS in 2005, as you all know, IFRS 3 scopes out common control combinations. And therefore, this accounting guideline, AG5, was developed and is based on the principles of merger accounting. This merger accounting method is closely aligned with the concept of the predecessor method. And is and at the time in 2005, many stakeholders considered that this method was the most appropriate. There's no requirement to use AG5 for these common control combinations, but serves as a guide. The concept underlying AG5 is essentially that there's no acquisition that has actually occurred, and that there has been a continuation of the risks and benefits from the ultimate parent's perspective. A summary of the methodology that is used is the entities are combined as if the combination had always existed. The carrying amounts that are used are from the ultimate parent's perspective. There's no recognition of goodwill, and there's a requirement to restate the comparatives of the new group using the same principles as stated as what I just said. There's no prescription as to where to recognize the difference between the consideration paid and the carrying value of the acquired entity's assets or liabilities. However, in AG5 appendix, where there are examples on the accounting methodology, the difference is recognized in equity within reserves. Now I'll just go through a brief outline of our observations obtained from a review of IPO prospectuses in 2014 and 13. So we reviewed 80% of IPO prospectuses that listed in Hong Kong in 2014 and 13. From this review, we note that generally listing applicants will conduct some form of common control combination. Usually a shell company is incorporated in conjunction with this combination, and together this is treated as a single transaction. This single transaction is accounted for using the predecessor method, and all applicants and all common control combinations pre-IPO were accounted for either using AG5 or the predecessor method. The financial statements were presented as if the group had always been combined, and the difference between the consideration paid and the net book value was recognized in equity, usually in merger reserves, capital reserves, or other reserves. We also noted that these pre-IPO companies generally had existing minority shareholders who typically were members of senior management or family members related to the controlling shareholders. Therefore, usually it is inferred that these minority interests would have similar interests as the ultimate parent and would likely have access to the relevant financial information.
Thanks, Cam. So to supplement our findings from the review of the IPO prospectuses, we also held discussions with practitioners, preparers, regulators, and analysts in Hong Kong to understand the accounting practice a bit better and what are the financial information needs. So the discussions focused on three simplified scenarios. The first scenario, in which all three scenarios are actually included in paper 6A. The first scenario illustrates a common control combination in a privately held group that is preparing for IPO. The second scenario illustrates a common control combination of a group that is already listed and 30% of its shares are held by the public. The third scenario illustrates a common control combination that includes the establishment of a new listing vehicle as the parent of a combination of existing businesses. So the practitioners whom we spoke to are technical accounting experts on this topic. Specific to scenario one, where it's a privately held group that is preparing for IPO, it is noted that the predecessor method in accordance with AG5 is applied in practice. But for the scenario two, that illustrates a group that is already listed and has 30% of its shareholdings is held by the public, the predecessor method is typically applied in the consolidated financial statements of the immediate acquirer or IP1. But the practitioners also note that the minority shareholders of IP1 might account for that investment using equity method, and therefore they might like to see the fair value information of the acquired business or the entity. In scenario three, now in this scenario it's quite common in Hong Kong for the purpose of IPO, and depending on the facts and circumstances, the one view is to treat the newly incorporated entity and the common control combination as one transaction before going IPO. And in this case, the predecessor method in accordance with AG5 is applied, as I think in practice they see that there hasn't been a change in the risk and benefits of the group from the ultimate parents' perspective. Another view is to apply the acquisition method for scenario three under IFRS, the acquisition method under IFRS 3 for scenario three. But this is only if the common control combination is conditional upon a successful listing. The cash proceeds from the IPO is then used to complete the common control combination. And if there is a significant change in control from the ultimate parent to the immediate acquirer. So in general, the practitioners note that the restatement of comparatives for common control combinations pre-IPO is reasonable, given that, you know, the Hong Kong listing requirements for a track record period. But the restatement of comparatives post-IPO may not be necessary, especially when it is not required by the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. In their experience, when accounting for common control combinations using the acquisition method, and this is some cases in Hong Kong, the fair value measurement aspect is the most costly and time consuming. So it is not surprising that most preparers don't appreciate the merits of the acquisition method, especially for common control combinations. And if given a policy choice, they would choose the predecessor method. So we also spoke to preparers who are senior finance or accounting personnel of listed companies and financial institutions. From their perspective, common control combinations are typically done to realize or improve the efficiencies of the group's business or to implement more efficient tax planning structures. They generally favored the predecessor method over the acquisition method, not just because of the simplicity in accounting, but also because they genuinely are concerned about the relevance of recognizing goodwill from related party transfers, if there is goodwill, and the subjectivity of fair values. And I think what they particularly think that the dynamics of the group may not have materially changed as compared to combinations that involve third-party acquisitions. They also commented that the concerns that they have around the relevance of actually of recognizing goodwill from related party acquisitions in the context of a common control combination is probably shared by other stakeholders of the entities as well. So this is particularly when debt financing is involved. They also commented that the restatement of comparatives for common control combinations is more so relevant in pre-IPO situations because they understand that the Hong Kong listing rules aside, they understand that potential investors would want to see the historical track record of the group as if they have always been combined. So specifically for the scenarios in all scenarios in one, two, specifically for scenarios one, two, and three in the paper, the preparers commented that the predecessor method is generally preferred, even though in reality some of them do apply the acquisition method to common control combinations, and particularly in scenario two. Mm-hmm. So that's when it's a post-IPO common control combination. One preparer commented that in emerging or semi-mature market conditions, fair values are more volatile, and so that may create opportunities for entities to distort the asset values if they account for common control combinations using the acquisition method. So weak corporate governance is a factor here. We also asked the preparers if they were minority shareholders of an investment that underwent common control combination, which method would they prefer to see, or would they prefer the entity use? And all preparers unanimously commented that they would still probably prefer predecessor method over the acquisition method, and perhaps some fair value information where relevant, like say for material items, should be provided as disclosures. So this is consistent with the comment made by our practitioners. We also met with regulators in charge of regulating listed issuers, in charge of administering the listing rules, and regulators in charge of the financial reporting compliance of publicly listed companies. They reported that they usually receive many complaints on the appropriateness of the accounting of some listed entities, particularly from minority shareholders, but none of those comments or complaints or concerns from investors relate to the information or financial information or the accounting on common control combinations in Hong Kong. So one regulator stressed the importance of having comparable and consistent accounting method for like common control combinations. And the regulator also pointed out that it's probably really useful for entities that undergo common control combinations to disclose the rationale underlying the consideration paid for a related party, especially when the premium for the transfer or the acquisition is paid. So this, they think that this would address any concerns about the validity of any premium paid on the related party. We met with certified financial analysts and investment practitioners who focused on a variety of industries as well. The analysts commented that the majority of financial statement users that are interested in new IPOs in Hong Kong consist of institutional investors, high net worth individuals and pension funds. So they have a level of, I wouldn't say a level of accounting knowledge, but they have got some sophistication to them. And the analysts commented that the predecessor method would be more useful compared to the acquisition method, especially in common control combinations, because carrying values, they pretty much use carrying values as for to conduct their own valuations and to calculate the price book ratio or ROE. The investor analysts in Hong Kong generally view fair value measurements with a high level of cynicism anyway. So, and that's because many entities in Hong Kong are family owned or family managed. So the analysts said that what they would like to see in terms of information disclosed in the notes of the reports is, for example, the underlying synergies or operational benefits that the entity expects to realize from the new combination, and maybe information on the fair value of material assets and liabilities of the acquired entity, the fair value methodology, the inputs, the assumptions, and interestingly, they would also be interested in the valuation expert, so they would like some information on the valuation expert. So just to recap on what the findings of our exercise, in Hong Kong, the predecessor method is used to account for common control combinations pre-IPO. Most of our stakeholders see more merit in using the predecessor method for common control combinations. Some of our stakeholders view the dynamics of a group that underwent a common control combination to be largely unchanged as compared to the dynamics arising from third-party acquisitions. There is a huge concern that the acquisition method might create opportunities for entities to artificially create or shift the asset values within the group and manipulate future profits through common control combinations. Basically, I think the concern is that it can be very easy to manipulate the figures of a loss-making entity by transferring it within the group and accounting for it using the acquisition method. The information that may be useful to minority shareholders in the context of common control combinations the fair value of material assets and liabilities, the inputs and assumptions, and the methodology of the valuation, and a description of the valuation expert. And lastly, irrespective of the existence of minority shareholders, all common control combinations should provide information on the rationale behind the common control combination, including the basis for why the consideration paid is higher than the net asset values. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what common control combinations in Hong Kong look like. We haven't actually asked any questions, but we'll be happy to see if there's any questions or comments on the exercise we did.
Thank you, Hans. Christina, first of all, I wanted to say thank you for a very interesting paper, which makes a significant contribution to the research we have been doing. And it also seems to support staff preliminary views that the predecessor values method is applied to all the most business combinations under common control. I have two questions for you, two interrelated questions, and this is almost challenging our own preliminary view. I'm particularly interested in the feedback you received on scenario two, where you had existing minority interest in the acquirer, and also the acquirer is a listed entity. And I guess what I'm interested in is why in that particular case the predecessor method.
Listen, guys, can you mute your mics because we have an echo?
Okay. Now you can go.
Okay, from the start.
go to your question.
Yes, so my question was on scenario two, and I was wondering why in this particular scenario, predecessor method is still seen as a better method. And I understand the argument about a related party transactions not necessarily happening on fair market terms, but it seems to me in that particular case, fair value information would provide more transparency if the exchange is not fair. So this is the first part of my question. And my second part of the question is, you mentioned specifically with users that some users said that carrying values are useful because they build their own valuation models and perform their own valuation based on carrying values. So I'm curious, would those users apply the same logic to a sort of regular business combination that is not under common control, or is that view specific to this type of transaction?
If it's okay, I'll turn on the mic now. I'll probably answer the second question first, Julia. I wouldn't say all the investor analysts whom we spoke to necessarily agree that business combinations not under common control, are not, so those under IFRS 3 is not useful. But I have to say that some of those investor analysts whom we spoke to said that, actually it wouldn't hurt if, business combinations, with external parties do also provide, information about, the synergies that they expect out of the new combination and so similar information that they have requested under common control. And going to your first question, I think there is one reason why predecessor method is applied in scenario two, where in a post IPO situation, it could actually be because the entity, when it went prior to going IPO, might have already made an accounting policy election. So, and because they've made an accounting policy election pre-IPO, for all future combinations, they basically have to consistently apply the predecessor method.
Anything further?
No, not from me.
Chris.
So I guess, Christina, my observation would be that even though they don't want the company itself to be doing fair values, what they're actually saying is that they need the fair value information. So I do find it somewhat disturbing that it seems to be a lack of faith in the company's ability to get the numbers right in the first place.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of say that that's the general sense we get in Hong Kong when it comes to fair value information. And I have to say that in this case, it's probably because most businesses in Hong Kong are family-owned or family-managed. The investor analysts themselves, though, I think they did say that if fair value information is indeed useful, then just disclose them, and what they would like to use it is just as a benchmark to the valuations that they themselves do. I think in terms of, because I remembered asking the preparers, so if they were shareholders or minority shareholders, for example, would they like to see the fair value information? And most of them do acknowledge that they would probably need the fair value information if they were to account for the investment at equity method.
It seems it'd be pretty hard for the analysts carry out the evaluation on carrying amounts, because carrying amounts can be anything, mm-hmm. depending on the history mm-hmm. of the company. They can be totally useless. The master.
My first comment is on the same line of Julia comment. I think that it's very much important for Business Commission and Common Control to understand when and how and why these are different from normal business combinations from related parties. And we have discussed a lot and worked a lot on that, and we think that when there are minority interests involved, probably, and because the entity is already listed, probably the level of governance and supervision within the entity ensures that the transaction is pretty much similar to what would have happened with unrelated parties. So from this kind of transaction, I would give more merits to use a purchase method rather than a predecessor method. And I understand the point of accounting policy choice at the very beginning, but when the entity chose the accounting policy before the IPO was pretty much different than when made the transaction after the IPO in terms of governance and controls and control system and all these things. So I think it would have merit to reconsider accounting policy choice in these cases. And another comment is about the scenario number three. When you say in your paper that one approach is to treat IP2 as the acquirer of S1, S2, S3 from P by using cash from the IPO proceeds, and that this would justify the use of purchase method, that is strange to me, because the way you structure the transaction, you obtain different accounting outcomes. So if you use the cash from IPO to buy the business after the IPO, you recognize a purchase method. If you do at the same time of the IPO, you go for the predecessor method. So it means that the form of transaction prevail on the accounting outcome, and would have welcomed exactly the opposite. I would say that the accounting account shouldn't be affected by the form of and the timing of the transactions.
I can ask a question.
You want to ask a question?
Yes, Thomas, I'd like to ask you a question, because it seems to me that the need for information of the existing shareholders at the level of the reporting entity, i.e. P, are probably different from the needs for information of the minority shareholders, which may exist in IP1 or later on in IP2 for scenario 3. So clearly there is kind of conflict between the needs of the existing ones and the other ones. Should we prioritize the needs of information of the shareholders of the reporting entity or the need for information of the minority shareholders? I think that's the key question in this common control transactions issue. When you have no minority shareholders, clearly there is no issue at all. Everyone says there is a problem when there are minority shareholders prior to the IPO or after the IPO. In a way, there is always minority shareholders after the IPO, but they need different information from the shareholders of the existing company. So what kind of priority should we give to the needs of those different parties, or should we rather maybe say kind of dual reporting, having two presentations depending on the needs of each group of shareholders?
I think that in scenario number two, IP1 is already listed. So what I call minority interest is like, you know, it's public. So when it's listed, we are after IPO, and this kind of transaction, you see, at 30% public is already before and after the transaction. So in this exact place, I agree with you, when there is a before IPO, after IPO, we can discuss what is the prevalence. But in this case, it was listed before, it's listed after, it's acquiring a business from a related party. I think that this 30% want to see exactly what is the value of the business acquired. That's my point of view.
So in that case, you would say apply the purchase method in scenario two,
yeah,
because of the needs of the existing minority shareholders.
Yeah.
And would you keep it up in the consolidation of P, or would you unwind it in the consolidation of P because the needs of the existing shareholders in P may...
I understand the point, but I think that from the P point of view, it didn't change because it didn't lose control of the business. So I agree with it.
Peter. I've got a question for Christina, really along the same lines as Philippe. You've reported what feedback you got from investors. It wasn't clear to me whether, and you may not know, whether the investors were commenting as possible capital providers to the intermediate parents, or whether they're the capital providers to the top parent looking for an extra source of information that's really outside the financial statements of the top parents. And I think you might get quite different answers depending on which perspective they're commenting from.
So the generally they were commenting on the immediate acquirer. They would like the information from the perspective of the immediate acquirer. They also, and this is probably, I'm not sure if we mentioned this in the report, but they've also commented about in Hong Kong we do have in scenario three, where you've got a new listing parent and some existing businesses transferred from the other parts of the group to IP2, they have said that they have seen transactions where the ultimate parent or the old immediate parent still sort of having some kind of relationship or transactions with the new IP2, and they're never really sure whether that relationship or that transaction has anything to do with the listing or the new group, and whether it is a form of payment between, you know, the new and the old parent entity. So I think what they would like to know is, even if the information, fair value information, is provided from the immediate acquirer's perspective, they would like to, I would say, more transparency on the related party transactions before and after the combination, so that they can sort of, I don't know, I think make more assumptions or guess on, you know, on what, how has the relationship actually changed?
Thank you, Hans. Also, thanks, Christina and Kim. The presentation you made that is very familiar with me, because actually the cases you raised, most of companies actually come from mainland China.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's familiar with me, but I have some observation as I understand. First of all, scenario three, if the company, you know, the entity P and all of subsidiaries are state-owned enterprises, as I understand, the government require them have to, you know, evaluate all of the assets and the liability for pre-IPO. And because they have to restructure the all of the assets and the liability for pre-IPO. So actually those assets and the liability will be measured at fair value in order to identify how much net assets the government own. And also it is for pricing of the stocks, if for IPO, how much price will be, you know, will be priced. So it's I understand that for IP2, in this case, subsidiary 1, subsidiary 2, subsidiary 3, all of those companies' assets and liability will be revaluated. And so this is, in my understanding, in my impression, so for state-owned enterprises, if they are go to IPO, they have to revaluate their assets and liability.
Thanks for that, Jen Chow. I think, well, you are right. I think we do see a lot of mainland, so PRC entities, so enterprises that are state-owned, listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. The 80%, as mentioned by Cam earlier, we did a study of 80% of the successful listing and prospectuses that were successful at listing in Hong Kong. Maybe Cam can give a flavor on what she's seen in terms of state-owned enterprises, but from our review, all of them do provide, do use the predecessor method. And so we can probably go back and maybe take a further look into whether they do provide fair value information separately, and for the purposes of listing in Hong Kong, because of the track record period requirement, they would also provide, they would use predecessor method. I don't know, Kevin.
You're right. I agree with the predecessor, you know, method, because in China, we do have accounting standards on business combination and common control. We adopted a predecessor method. But for pre-IPO situation, especially for state-owned enterprises, there's special requirement there. Because if you adopt the book value, the problem is that those state-owned enterprises has a long history, maybe more than 50 or 60 years old. So their book value is very, very low, cannot, you know, reflect their real financial position. So this is why the government have them, just like you have to restructure all of the assets and liability to form a new accounting firm, new company. So you evaluate all of the asset liability to identify how much net assets do government have. So this is a special situation. In general, we favor that predecessor method for common control and for units and combination and common control. We agree with that, but there is an exception for in the case for pre-IPO. And in Chinese accounting standards, actually, this case not included our standards. This is the government requirement for pre-IPO. And sometimes we don't think this is a business combination and common control. It's just organize a new firm, and you have to evaluate asset liability, something like that. So actually, there are no goodwill be recognized. Yeah, so it's I think it's different. Yeah, this is the point I would like to make it clear.
Kim?
Thanks, Hans. Just to pick up on the point that Philippe made about, you know, well, do you have different approaches focusing on different shareholders? I suppose the common control and the scoping out of IFRS 3 raises the question around, well, are we focusing on the reporting entity itself, or the entity with some shareholders? In other words, from the entity itself, does it really make a difference where it acquired the assets from? It has acquired some assets. So, and I suppose maybe it's easier to see the predecessor approach if it is a wholly owned subsidiary, because you sort of then somehow say, well, nothing's really changed. But the interesting thing that came to mind was that somebody might not be a current shareholder, and subsequently they do acquire shares. The sort of history now matters, just because the transaction happened to have been conducted in a particular way. So I suppose maybe what's not really clear, even in terms of the current scope out of IFRS 3, is the scope out just a practical expedient, because at the P consolidated level you have to undo what was done, you know, below if IFRS 3 was applied at an IP1 level, that has to all be undone. Is that the main driver, or is there some conceptual basis why at an IP1 you would do something different just because the transaction happens to be with somebody under common control? So I'm just saying that it does raise a very interesting question, because, and I'm sure we'll get into it in the discussion, you know, that will come now, but, you know, we've had some situations in South Africa where these common control transactions have taken place and new shareholders have been brought in, let's say, at an IP1 level, and the entity, let's say IP1, has borrowed money to buy the business at fair value. Let's say that's 10 million, but the predecessor values are 2 million. So now you bring in these predecessor values of 2 million, the liability of 10, and your financial statements show a negative equity of 8. And people say, but does this really make any sense? So yes, maybe if the transactions were structured sort of as paper transactions, I don't know, again, if that should make a difference, but, you know, maybe one could justify saying you're just shuffling things around. But if real money is, say, being borrowed and paid, your financial statements now don't look really that great. So what's interesting is, even though, yes, at a P consolidated level, things would need to be undone, there have been motivations for doing full IFRS 3 at an IP1 level, because there's this concern around these financial statements don't really reflect what's happened. So, yeah, those are sort of my concerns.
Steve.
Question for Jin Chao. So, you apply the predecessor method, but revalue these subsidiary assets where they're state-owned, formerly state-owned. How do the comparatives work in that situation?
For comparative data, actually, these companies have to restate based on the revaluation basis. So actually, from my point of view, actually, the past maybe 3 years data does not mean, you know, so much. But in order to meet the listing rules, they have to, you know, perform, you know, this kind of data. Yeah, in my understanding.
So they have to push back the fair values for two years, past three years. Then you get hindsight problems, surely. And
yeah, because this is actually restructured. The company has been restructured, and all of the assets liability has been become new. You know, it's like a new company. But in order to go to public, they have to prepare the past 3 years' data. So I don't think it's really useful for quite useful for investors. But this is my understanding. It's especially for state-owned enterprises. Yeah, it actually have very different situation for those companies.
Chris.
So I think Kim raises a really good point. The concern I have about this project is that I'm not sure about what the conceptual underpinning actually is. And I think it's critical that we really know what it is that we're trying to do. So you could actually say that if you're looking at the reporting of any of these entities underneath P, it's an extract of the group. And then that would take you down predecessor values. But if you said, well, actually, no, the reason why I'm doing financial statements of these lower entities is because in its own right it is a reporting entity, that would take you down a different path, that fair value might be the right answer. So just as a little bit of history, in Australia, before we moved to IFRS, we actually had got to a point where any significant transfers between entities in a group were actually being done at fair value. And that was a combination of the accounting standard and also the regulator pushing that through. So we were more sort of in that camp that if you're doing these financial statements, really then the fair value approach is the approach that we thought users were going to get the most information out. But I just find it really difficult to give you constructive feedback if I don't actually know on what basis we're really trying to operate here. So I think it's really important that we go back and think about the conceptual underpinnings of what these particular types of financial statements actually are in the first place.
Andreas?
Thanks, Hans. My comments tie into Chris's, Kim's, and also to Philippe's question. I think that is the real question, what's the conceptual underpinning? If I look into the Big Four commentaries, I think they unanimously state that predecessor accounting seems to be justified if the transaction lacks commercial substance. And I recall a vivid discussion we had at the global firm of my former employer as to what exactly does that mean. Because you probably find commercial substance in virtually everything, because otherwise you won't do it. I mean, nobody feels so bored in shoveling just boxes around. So there must be a reason. It could be a tax reason, could be God knows what. So is that really a robust concept? And I think we came to the conclusion, no, probably is not, but it feels good. So I would echo I would echo Chris's comment, saying really, what's the conceptual reasoning? And so far, my emphasis has always been on the NCI to answer Philippe's question. I think that's the real difference. What they are entitled to, is it just A, or is it A plus B, or mixture of two?
Linda, and let's then move to Julia.
Just a quick comment, echoing some of the other things. I think you need to take into consideration why the transaction is being done, because in Canada, depending on which note I'm looking at here, 70% of these transactions are not in contemplation of any IPO of any sort. They're tax-driven within the consolidated entity. And if that's happening, it's hard to argue that anything at the consolidated level has changed as a result. However, interestingly enough, under Canadian tax and, by recollection, U.S. tax law, you actually have to do those transactions at fair value. So their fair value information is available because you have to do it for tax purposes, but you eliminate all that. It becomes a book tax basis at the top of the house, and you eliminate all that. So it's interesting in terms of just making sure you understand the nature of the transaction conceptually. So your guidance may have to be different depending on that.
wouldn't that generally be the case? If tax is the angle, wouldn't it generally be the case that transactions are taking place at an arm's length value and therefore will be effectively a fair value in many jurisdictions?
Well, it would be, except that you're going to reverse, under current accounting, we reverse that all for at the consolidated level. And then you get into the complexities of where do you want to do that. The added complexity is push-down accounting being available and required under U.S. GAAP but not available under I4S, and you go through all of that stuff, too. Not sure that's within the scope of this discussion today, but that stuff is there. Yeah.
Okay. Julia.
Thank you, Hans. This is a very interesting discussion, actually, and I think our original main purpose for this discussion was to talk about how the predecessor method should be applied as opposed to which method should be applied. But still, I think this discussion highlights a key challenge that we have in this project, which is why these transactions in the first place are excluded and what, if anything, makes them different from regular business combinations under common control. So I think at a very high level where we are at the moment, just in terms of a quick update. So this year we have been doing targeted research primarily with use of financial statements, but also with you and with preparers and with regulators. And firstly, we focused in our outreach and research on what is the most appropriate method and why, and then more recently we also focused on how the predecessor method is applied. And I think it's fair to say that we have a degree of comfort that A, in practice, the prevailing method seems to be the predecessor method, and also I think it's fair to say that there is a general a degree of support for actually requiring requiring predecessor method for all or most business combinations under common control. But then the immediate next question that you have is, are there any circumstances and are there any factors that need to be considered which may lead you to a different answer in a particular subset of transactions? So for example, to Tomas's point, if you have existing NCI in acquirer, why the information needs are any different from information needed in a regular business combination? And similarly, to Kim's point, if transaction happened certainly at fair value and cash has been exchanged, does that matter? And my favorite is one that Andreas raised, let's look at whether the transaction has economic substance, but then the question is how you capture the idea of economic substance in a standard. And I suppose a big challenge is if we were to try and draw the line and to say, okay, for these particular types of transactions, you use one method, and for another type of transactions, you use a different method, you immediately potentially open the door of structuring, and people change little bits and pieces to get the desired accounting outcome. So this is all very challenging. But I think regardless of whether we are able and find it appropriate to draw a line and to say that some transactions should fall under IFRS 3 and others should be accounted for under the predecessor method, in any case, we also need to think about how the predecessor method should be applied. And our research has shown so far that there doesn't seem to be any consensus, and there seems to be diversity, certainly in available guidance on how this method should be applied. And what we thought would be really helpful for us in our further thinking and research is to get your views on how this method should be applied. And to do that, we prepared a set of illustrative scenarios that are provided in your slide deck. And maybe in the interest of time, I will skip sort of the introductory part, but I will just highlight that when we apply the acquisition method, we have four main questions to answer, and those questions are: how do we measure acquired assets and liabilities, how we measure consideration, where we take any difference between the two, and what we do with comparative. So acquisition method gives us answer to those questions. Similar questions arise under the predecessor method. So if we move to slide 13, in the slide deck, slide 13 highlights the questions that we would like to discuss, and I think some of those questions are arguably easier than others. So the first question is, okay, once we've decided how consideration in a business combination under common control is measured and how acquired assets and liabilities are measured, where in equity should any difference go? Does it go to retained earnings, reserve, share capital? So that's the first question that, we would like to discuss. The second question is, okay, how do you measure consideration in a business combination under common control? And what I would like to highlight here in the avoidance, for the avoidance of confusion, we're not talking about measuring consideration for the purpose of separate financial statements of the acquirer, which is outside of the scope of the project, at least at this point in time. We are talking about how to measure consideration for the purposes of applying the predecessor method and for the purposes of figuring out the difference that will be recognized in equity. And we would particularly like to focus on measuring consideration in the form of shares, because A, it's a fairly common form of consideration, but also because if it is cash, it's arguably quite easy to measure. The next question is, which historical values, what are the predecessor values? Are these the values of the transferred entity, or are these the values somewhere high up in the group? And finally, what we do with comparatives and from what date we combine those entities. So if we look, I'm just thinking how best to do it in the time that we have left. So maybe as a very quick sort of look at the numbers, if we go back to slide 9, so this is the fact pattern which we discussed back in March. So here we have existing NCI in the accounting acquirer, and we have information about fair value of the issued shares. So here A acquires B by issuing shares to P1. So fair value of issued shares is 120, nominal value is 20, and fair value of assets and liabilities of entity B is 118. So that's our fact pattern. And also on slide 10, we have information about what's recorded in separate financial statements of entity A acquirer and entity B, the transferred entity, just before the business combination under common control. So with that, if we move to our first question, which will be slide 15. So the first question is about where in equity should any difference between consideration and acquired net assets be recognized. So in our example, predecessor values of acquired net assets is 110, consideration is 120, so we have three options what we could do with resulting difference of 10. We could put it into share capital, which is illustrated on slide 15. So as a result, you can see that share capital of entity A in A's consolidated financial statements is different from what is presented in separate financial statements. Alternatively, on slide 16, we can put the difference of 10 into consolidated retained earnings. And as a result, consolidated retained earnings are below retained earnings of entity A. And finally, the last alternative on slide 17, we can put this difference in reserves, for example, as a special merger reserve, which provides a degree of added transparency. And on this particular question, staff preliminary view is that probably the ISB should not prescribe where in equity this difference is recognized, because the ISB typically does not prescribe it, and we would be interested in your views.
Tommaso.
I'd like to respond to the question 1, but I first want to respond to the question 3. there's a lot of discussion about whether you should make reference to historical values of the separate financial statements of the equity, or whether to the consolidated financial statement of the parent. I think that, you know, if the predecessor method, the final outcome, if there are many mergers, would be that the effect of mergers will be exactly equal to what the consolidated financial statement of the parent says. So, to me, you should make reference to the value in the consolidated financial statement of the parent. And if it is the starting point, I think that when you, and I go to the question 1, when you make the adjustment just the numbers of entity B being consolidated in entity A, you should first of all consider that the investment in entity B was carried at 100 in the entity P1 financial statement. So first of all, you have, but you have revalued to 120 in the separate financial statement of entity A. So first of all, you have to adjust this number to 100 to make it exactly the same amount the carrying amount was in entity P1, and then you should apply the exact same consolidation procedure that would have applied in P1 consolidated financial statements. So at the end of the day, I would see the effects in terms of adjustment would be just what we have in slide 10 when you consolidated B. So it would be minus 100 of investment in sub B, minus 20 of share capital, and minus 80 of return earnings, because you create exactly the same effect you would have been if you make reference to the consolidated financial statement of P1 figures.
We will probably need to play with the numbers to fully understand what you're proposing.
And what I mentioned before, first of these adjustments, you have to adjust the figure of participation recognized in entity A financial statement, that it was 120. You have to move it to 100, and then you apply the other.
To answer question one to myself?
the second one is, I started from question three to respond to question one.
Thank you. We agree with the ISB staff's view that the ISB should not prescribe where in equity the difference should be recognized. Because where there is a difference between the consideration for acquisition and net amount of acquired asset and liability, such a difference has various nature in the separate financial statement, and the component in equity are affected by the legal and regulatory requirement in each jurisdiction. Therefore, it's difficult to determine which alternative is appropriate. Rather, it's necessary to judge appropriately based on the fact and circumstances in compliance with the legal requirement of each jurisdiction.
Ken?
Thanks. I'll keep it short. I'm in agreement.
Jen Chow?
First of all, I agree with that. If there is any difference, those differences should be recognized in equity. But I would like to introduce Chinese approach. Yeah, actually, as separate statement, we also adopted a predecessor approach. That means the number showed here for entity A, the investment in subsidiary B in China is not 120. That is not fair value of the equity. Actually, we're using the book value of the entity. Book value of the net assets of the entity B, so that is the 110. So in this case, the investment in for entity A, the investment in subsidiary B, the number is 110, and net assets current and entity B have is 110. So in this case, there will be no difference in China. Yeah.
I think it's a fair comment. I think it becomes a little bit more complicated if, for example, the consideration is paid in cash rather than shares.
Yeah.
And then you can have a different number.
Yes. So in China, if the entity acquired the equity, you know, all entity pay in cash. So maybe pay 120 to acquire all of the equity of entity B, so there will be a difference, 10.
Yeah.
So those 10 go directly to the equity, we call capital reserve.
Okay.
Because you're answering question two.
Mm-hmm. They're interrelated, yeah.
One he?
I received comments from some ASH members, and they all agreed that ISP should not be so prescriptive about where inequity the difference should be recognized. And some members cited the reason as that such prescription would cause some difficulty due to the different legal requirements across jurisdictions. And in addition, another member said that the ISP should consider requiring entities to make an accounting policy choice so that entities follow a consistent approach in accordance with ISA requirements.
Chris?
Australia and New Zealand would agree that you shouldn't prescribe where inequity it goes. So people have mentioned legal issues, but there's also tax consequences as well. So that causes grief. And it was New Zealand that actually raised the issue about the accounting policy choice. Australia wouldn't be quite so strict.
Andreas?
I also agree that you shouldn't be prescriptive for the basic reason that you don't have a concept of equity under IFRSs. So it doesn't make sense to me to have any presentation following on that. If you wanted to prescribe one, my second preference would be to put it in other reserves, though.
Okay.
Because share capital and retained earnings do have carried meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be complete, there was agreement arising from our discussion as well.
Okay.
Okay, which I suppose takes us to question two, which we already touched upon. And question two is about how to measure consideration in the form of shares. And we have presented two alternatives here on slide 10. Fair value of transfer shares is measured at fair value, 120. And then on slide 21, transfer shares and consideration are measured at nominal value of the transfer shares of 20. And I suppose one observation that I would like to make here is that when consideration is transferred in the form of shares, the only difference that measurement makes for the purposes of applying the predecessor method, the only difference is in presentation of equity. Assets and liabilities are recognized at exactly the same values. So we don't really think that the answer to this question will have any sort of impact in practice, and we would be very interested in your views.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, for me, and I know you're saying we're looking at the consolidated financials, so if we are, then I sort of say, well, I don't really see why this makes a difference. You know, if we're looking at A's separate financial statements and what you're showing, the investment and all that, you know, it possibly has a greater bearing. But if we're going to use predecessor values, I suppose my question is, well, does it really make a difference if it sits in equity? And particularly given local jurisdiction statutory requirements regarding how you measure share capital. So I'd be almost inclined to not prescribe anything and say it's up to local jurisdictions. I mean, if you have to measure your share capital at fair value, well, you'll do that and the difference just goes into equity. I mean, the other alternative is you just simply use the predecessor value. So in this case, you just use 110. You're just moving things around. So if it is shares, I think IFRS should be silent and it's subject to jurisdiction's legal requirements.
Andreas?
I would echo what Kim is saying, and there is an important addition to that. In the majority of the capital increase that we've seen in our jurisdiction, the shares don't have any nominal value. So I think there's no other way than doing it as fair value, I think. But I would echo what Kim has said, just don't be prescriptive.
Kim?
So the same reaction if you're not going to prescribe on issue one, prescribing the treatment on issue two seems a little, perhaps unnecessary.
Want to
hear? Yeah, all AS members supported the fair value measurement, and you know, one member also noted that some jurisdictions may not have the concept of nominal or par value.
So Australia and New Zealand would support not specifying something like a nominal value, because neither of us actually have that concept anymore. But I do think you need to look at the example that China gave, so I don't think you can exclude the fact that it should be the book value of the shares, the book value of the assets being transferred. And again, I'd bring you back to what's your conceptual basis here, because I do think you need one somewhere. And if you want to use an extract of financial statements, then that's an extract approach, and that will give you justification for doing that.
I agree about conceptual basis, which I think will probably become particularly important in question three. I do think, though, that in Chinese example, there is still no impact on consolidated assets and liabilities. It's just the presentation and equity that would be different, just an observation.
Thank you. Under the business combination and business combination under the common control, we might suggest that the consideration in the form of shares should be measured at the difference between the net value of the transfer assets and liabilities.
Chen Chao.
I'm sorry, China has a different view, as as Mohi said. Not all of OSG agree with fair value approach. Yeah. Anyway, China, if the companies, you know, provide the consideration in the form of the shares, in China disagree with fair value approach. We agree with the book value approach, as I mentioned, that in this case there should be 110, not 120.
Linda?
Just quick to say, we would not object to fair value, but we would be concerned about nominal value, because not all the shares are required to have a nominal value in Canada, so we would have no value to go to if you went to nominal value.
Okay.
Yeah. We heard both, I mean, arguments in favor of both options, either fair value on the basis of the book values and exclusion of nominal value.
Okay.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, Tommaso. Yeah, just a small question or comment. I mean, does the in separate financial statements of NTDA, does the fair value approach meet the general recognition criteria in IAS 27 that the investment should be recognized at cost?
Well, that's why I specified that this discussion is only in the context of applying the predecessor method. So it's all about what happens sort of on consolidation and what end result you have in equity. Would do not touch upon what happens in separate financial statements.
Okay. I remember people making the choices and being told that they were not holding the right issues.
Question three is about which predecessor value should be used. And this is one question in the slide deck where we have not presented staff preliminary view. So here we have two alternatives. So alternative one on page 25. So here we use the carrying values of assets and liabilities of entity B itself, so 110. And alternative two on slide 26. Here we use carrying values recorded with respect of entity B at the higher level of consolidation, at the level of P1. And so as a result, assets and liabilities of entity B are recorded at 115, and then obviously we have a difference in equity. So our question for you is, which carrying values should be used under the predecessor method? And why?
Thanks, Andy. Just a comment and then, well, maybe two comments. I mean, if entity B in its own financial statements doesn't apply IFRS, I'm presuming it means that you can't use the predecessor values per entity B financial statements, presumably.
Who
would have to be restated.
Right. So now it has to go through a whole first time adoption, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, again, maybe it's unlikely to occur, but I guess it is just a point to say, well, if it doesn't even apply. Or if in its separates, maybe it applies IFRS but has different accounting policies. Again, is that okay? So at a consolidated level, you know, the policies might be different even though they're both entities are applying IFRS. And I suppose, again, it goes back to the point that Chris, you know, has been saying we need a conceptual basis. So if this is meant to be a practical expedient because at a... What is it, a P1 level, forgotten whatever the parent, the ultimate parent entity, if the view is, well, whatever is done at a consolidated level gets undone, it might just be easier to use the P1 values.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, you know, it's difficult to really define what the conceptual basis is when we're not quite sure what the purpose is.
Okay. Any transaction under the business combination, business combination under the common control is just a transfer of net asset within a group and internal transactions from the parent perspective. Therefore, to avoid any differences of net asset before and after the business combination, asset and liabilities acquired by a receiving company should be measured by the book value of transfer within the group. Therefore, that means alternative two of the ISB staff's analysis is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Kim?
So I might have been a little bit confused in the fact pattern and wondered if you're starting to get into, at least in the US, the guidance we have on pushdown.
Yeah.
That is, when does a subsidiary have to use the basis of its parents in its standalone financial statements? And I thought that's what this question was effectively asking, because if you have to apply pushdown under IFRS, how could you have a different basis at the subsidiary than the parent? And so it seemed like this was getting into broader, at least I wonder if you're getting into broader new basis issues.
I think there is an interaction, obviously, but it's not about entity B using in its separate financial statements the values which are recorded at P1 level. It's about which values are assigned to B at entity A level. So it's a slightly different question, but there is a relation, I agree.
Jane
Chow? I don't agree with the alternative two. The reason is that the procedural approach, the value of the entity, in which case can be used simply because the entity B become the group member. After that, okay, so we agree with the alternative two, not alternative one, because alternative one at that time, entity B has not yet become the member of the group.
One B?
Yes. AOC members support using carrying amount as per entity P, but one member noted that in cases where the parent does not prepare IFRS financial statement, then values from transferee's own book could be used. And another member pointed out that this information based on entity P would be also relevant to NCI.
Okay.
Which takes us to question four about how comparative information should be presented and from which date the combining entities should be accounted as one entity. And here on slide 29, we have a little bit of additional information. So we also have information about comparative year. And on slide 30, we have alternative one, where combining entities are only combined from the date of transaction, and the newly created group is accounted for as a group from the date of transaction, and comparative information is not restated. So on slide 30, you can see that comparative year includes only entity A, and accumulated profits and retained earnings of entity B are eliminated on consolidation on application of the predecessor method. And then on slide 31, comparative information is restated. So comparative year includes entity A and entity B, as if these entities have been combined already then. And retained earnings of entity B are not eliminated on consolidation. Now, we understand that in practice, often comparative information gets restated. Yet our preliminary view is that comparative information should not be restated. And this is because restatement essentially would present an entity which didn't really exist at this point in time. So conceptually, it seems a little bit hard to find it appropriate. But also we understand that it's quite it can create a lot of operational challenges. So for example, if the acquired acquired business is not an entity but is part of the group, there is a question about how you actually allocate income and expenses to this particular acquired business. So there are operational challenges as well. So our preliminary view is that comparative should not be restated, and we welcome your thoughts on that.
And in our discussion, I think there was agreement with your proposal, not restating, and for the reasons that you have explained, that you restate when you change accounting policies, but not to report as if things had existed that have not. However, the usefulness of some pro forma information for users was also highlighted.
Disclosure, for example.
Yukio, we agree with the ISP staff's view that the entity should be combined from the date of the transaction, and the comparative information should not be restated.
So I think part of it gets to what would be useful in terms of predecessor financials, because if you don't combine or present as if they were combined, I think you can at least through the form of the transaction then entirely control what's available for predecessor periods, because you could put a new co in there which would have no operations prior and combine in that and then have no predecessor information, or you could have A merge with B or B merge with A, or in a put together transaction decide which. And so I think I don't disagree with the approach, but I think people will struggle with then how do I get that pro forma information. So I think that becomes a pretty important question.
Jin Zhao.
We agree with the restatement approach. That means that the newly recreated group should be accounted for as it has always existed.
Statement.
Chris?
Yeah, restatement, yeah.
So once again, it comes back to what you think your conceptual basis is. So if you think it's an extract, then I don't see how you could discount people from actually providing comparative information, because basically you're just saying, I'm taking it from here and I'm putting it here. However, I would note that in Australia, the regulator would certainly agree with the proposal that you're taking. And New Zealand has mixed views on this one and hasn't yet formed a final view.
Wanhee?
Well, I have three comments from AOSIS members and two members that the financial statement should be prepared as if it had been always been combined. And one member just said that, as Chris mentioned, that New Zealand said that they have mixed views among constituents.
Kim?
Yeah, I would support the view of no restatement, but obviously subject to clarification on the conceptual basis.
Okay. Chris?
Can I just note there's also a bigger issue, which is that quite often entities are being asked to do carve-outs and combine financial statements. and there's a really big issue as to whether or not those are actually IFRS compliant. Mm. So I think as part of this project, you should also be having a look at that as well, because that would certainly provide some much needed clarity.
Yeah.
Mm. Summarize, okay. So I think what we've heard is that we need to think really hard about the conceptual basis for whatever we're doing. And I definitely agree with that there is an interrelation between different questions that we've discussed today. For example, I agree with the case. It seems to me that if we were not to require a statement of comparatives, logically it seems to me that then taking parents' values does not really sit together with that approach. But that's something we will need to think about. So I think we've heard a degree of support for not prescribing way in equity to recognize any difference between consideration and acquired net assets. And also I think a degree of support to not actually answering question two, i.e. how to measure consideration in the form of shares, given that we're not touching equity anyway. But again, we need to think about it as a broader conceptual questions. I think we had heard mixed views on question three, and we will need to do a count, but I think we probably heard a little bit more support in favor of using parents' values, but we will need to go through our notes carefully. And then on the last question, I think the majority support was for not restating.
I'd like to go back for 1 minute, if we can, to the point made by Chris about the combined financial statements. I think it's a related but a bit different issue in a way. This is a point which has come out several times in the outreach I participated in during the conceptual framework outreach, because we mentioned in the framework the possibility of having combined financial statements under IFRS. It's a couple of lines, no criteria, no objective, no how to do it. It's just after consolidated and separate, so it's kind of different statements, and we don't say anything. Do you think it would be wise to say a little bit more at the level of the conceptual framework, not trying maybe to go into the how-to, because it's more standards level, but conceptually to address what is the purpose of combined financial statements and what would make them compliant with the spirit of IFRS, as opposed to any form of combinations which people could prepare, and we don't know whether it serves any purpose.
Andreas?
Clearly, yes.
Yes.
Because I think it would be rather awkward if a regulator or a stock exchange came along and said, you have to prepare X, Y, Z, and please follow IFRS's. And then the IFRS themselves say, sorry, this is not within our remit, or you can't do that, and you can never label that IFRS compliant. I think that would be the worst thing that I could see happen. So therefore, clearly, yes.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this discussion. We thank Christina and Kemp for their contribution from Hong Kong.